on the mother's side of my family, you had a good old-fashioned Jewish-American Zionist family. On my father's side, a totally different story. These were French Jews who fought in the Parisian resistance. They were card-carrying communists and anti-Zionists for a century.
Can you give me a few anecdotes, perhaps, of just what it was like being detained? Personal experiences, experiences you saw?
And they ripped people out of cells, you know, shackled them and hands and ankles, threw them in a kind of birdcage in the sun without any food or water in isolation for hours and hours and hours and hours until we tried to get them back.
You've spoken about how this awful genocide, the acceleration of Israel's brutality, which all of us are seeing, has really made finding yourself being a Jew in this world complicated.
I know a lot of people who, in the choice between kind of exit voice and loyalty to the Jewish identity, have chosen exit. Corner, gas station coffee.
Yeah.
Or just Nescafe.
Yeah.
Instant.
Yeah.
I'm a simple man.
No. People who have Americano are either that or not.
No. The coffee culture, never understood it.
Okay, I'm just going to take about 4 seconds to settle down. You good, Ahmed? Okay, one, two, I'm just going to clap. One, two, three, let's go. Hi, good day, and welcome to another episode of Unapologetic. I'm your host, Ashfaq Karim, and I'm very pleased today to welcome to the show David Adler. David, welcome to the show.
My first time in the studio. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to having you here at Middle East Eye. So, David, I mean, some of you here may be familiar with him. You've probably seen some of his posts on Twitter and maybe seen some of his other social media activity. He was recently on the Sumud Flotilla. He's American. He's Jewish. He's been involved in a bunch of things, not just Palestinian activism or pro-Palestinian activism, but also trying to sort of, I mean, we'll get into it a bit in the conversation, but he's been involved in a lot of building global alliances to kind of counter a lot of problems that we have in the world today. So David, welcome to the show again. I mean, you got into the studio a few minutes ago and you asked me what we're going to cover, and honestly, it's your story. How did you end up on the flotilla? How did you end up doing what you're doing? Who are you?
Yeah, I think there's two ways to answer that question. One, a story of kind of political formation and how I ended up in a space concerned with questions of international coordination. You know, we live in a world today where the far right is galloping across the world into power and onto our streets, from here in London to my country of origin, the United States, and around the world. So those are a set of political questions that I think relate to my personal trajectory. And there's a second set of questions which have to do with my Jewish identity, which has to do with the community I grew up in Los Angeles, California, the streak of Zionism that I think afflicts a lot of the Jewish American diaspora, and then how those sets of questions relate to my participation or the moral conviction that brought me onto the flotilla and into this confrontation with the State of Israel. So why don't I start with the second set of questions and then
sure,
say
sure.
a bit about the first
yeah,
one.
Yeah.
So I grew up in a very conflicted house in California. On the mother's side of my family, you had a good old-fashioned Jewish-American Zionist family. These were people who felt doubly fortunate to be living in the greatest country in the world, the United States of America, but even luckier to have an extra homeland built by our Jewish compatriots on the occupied Palestinian territory over in the newly founded State of Israel. And that was a very common feeling, I think, for a lot of Jewish Americans, especially in a place like Los Angeles, was a sense of pride in the project of the State of Israel, a sense of allegiance to it, and a sense of proximity as well.
Was it proximity and allegiance, or were they also kind of like really zealous Zionists?
It was a much more casual, much more impulsive Zionism. That was the Zionism I grew up in. It was a less defensive, more celebratory one.
Okay.
I think it's mutated and changed, become much more defensive, much more vicious in how it reacts to a countercurrent. But it was so hegemonic in that Jewish community of Los Angeles on my mother's side that it was not. It was more like Israel Day and passing around
Absolutely,
the blue box where you want to pay for the Jewish National Fund. Little did we know as young children that was being used to dispossess, occupy, evict Palestinians from their ancestral territories, you know. In that part of the Jewish community, it was really about a kind of blind faith and allegiance tied to programs like Birthright, which if your viewers or listeners don't know about it, was a program that funded, free of charge, Jewish diasporic communities to travel to Israel, you know, meet the IDF and have a good old time and develop these affective ties. So my mother's side was like that. My father's side, a totally different story. These were French Jews who fought in the Parisian resistance. They were card-carrying communists and anti-Zionists for a century, for long before the foundation of the State of Israel, when it struck to my father's side of the family like a criminal enterprise that was not just hostile to Palestinians living in those ancestral territories, but was actually kind of anti-Semitic in its relationship to the Yiddish culture that was felt like it belonged to my father's family. Why are we being told to leave Europe? Why are these Zionists collaborating with the anti-Semites on the old continent to try to get us out of here? This is our rich culture that we've built in places like Germany and France, where my father's family is from. So I grew up kind of in the tension between these two Jewish diasporic traditions.
And but the thing is, would you, as a young person, how did you see that conflict between your mom and dad and your mom's family and dad's family kind of play out? Like, how did they coexist? And when did, I mean, I guess you're going to get to that part of the story now, but when did you start seeing the fractures?
Oh, well, this was every day at the dinner table. Okay. I can remember.
So like as an eight-year-old, like a six-year-old, younger.
Yeah, celebration of Passover was always a very pyrotechnic event. So we'd get, you know, everyone around the table. In the diversity of this kind of family composition, you had everyone from my father on the one side, whose house we would celebrate Passover, which is the celebration of the Exodus from Egypt and is supposed to be a moment in which we are not just grateful for our own freedoms, but take stock of the oppression of other peoples. So for my father on the one side, Passover was an opportunity for us to reflect on the plight of the Palestinian people suffering at the hands of our, you know, Jewish compatriots, right? But for my great uncle Irving, who was a general in the U.S. Army present in 1948 for the founding of the State of Israel, who became so enraged with my father, he started wearing his army fatigues to the Passover Seder just to give him the middle finger to his face. So I think a lot of those contradictions played out in front of my eyes and at the dinner table in ways that were really generative. And they played out, I think I'm speaking on behalf of a lot of diasporic Jews, maybe here in Britain as well, to say that this was a very dynamic relationship that to the practices of the State of Israel. So, you know, in my senior year of university, my last year of university, I both had a standing invitation that gets sent somehow to all of the members of the Jewish community to go on this birthright trip, to go to the State of Israel and, you know, hang out and develop those affective ties, as well as I was seeing in the newspapers and on my computer screen images from so-called Operation Protective Edge, one of the most lethal campaigns
of devastation.
So it was
2012, right?
14.
2014, yeah.
So I think that cognitive dissonance for a lot of the – or that communal dissonance, I should say, for a lot of the diaspora, I think, has now come to a head. I want to pause there for a second just to say, I think, something important about anti-Zionist Jewish identity, which all even on that side has a tension in its own right. So for a long time after I left university, this comes to the other side of my story, I lived and worked in other parts of the world. I followed my supervisor in university to live in Delhi in India, where I was examining questions of housing provision and slum redevelopment and how the Indian state tries to take care of its people. And I was fascinated by these developmental questions. And then I moved on a research fellowship to Mexico and fell in love with Latin America and was dealing with fascinating questions there too of the rights to the city and the struggles for democracy and lots of interesting high political questions that came to dominate a lot of my political life. And it's relevant for the question around Palestine because for a long time I strongly believed that it was important to defend a Jewish identity that did not always define itself in relation to the State of Israel. That might sound crazy, but if you look at even a lot of Jewish American culture in the post-war period, that was the case. A writer like Philip Roth, his fiction is very much concerned with Jewish identity, but it's not preoccupied with the question of Israel. Woody Allen, say what you will about the guy. His movies are very Jewish, but they're not dealing with the question of the State of Israel. Larry David, Curb Your Enthusiasm, great film, makes great television. Seinfeld, Curb Your Enthusiasm. These are inflected with a Jewish American cultural tradition. They're not first and foremost preoccupied with the question of Zionism. And that was because, And it might strike us as odd now because the state of Israel has been so successful, principally in the past 25 years, really, this century, at establishing itself as the hegemonic node of the definition of the Jewish identity. And so for a long time, I felt a certain resistance to accepting that, to say, you know, I'm a Latin Americanist. I live and work in this region, and I don't know those people. I don't have family over there. You know, I have a certain political loyalty to the cause of Palestinian liberation, but why should I, you know, why should I be accountable for the crimes of the State of Israel in some way? In the same way that, you know, I thought, you know, Muslims in Indonesia, for example, shouldn't have to be accountable for the behavior of the Saudi monarchy, for example, right? So for a long time, I held on to that, but it was an untenable position.
So there's two things. So you've mentioned the tension in your family, but and then you've thrown in that you were already kind of pro-Palestinian, so you don't explain how that happened, right? So, I mean, why did you choose your father's side? and then the other thing is also how did you, like, what led you to accept that, like, you can't accept this position of I'm not responsible for what Israel's doing as a Jewish person?
I think that there is a question of the practices and policies of the State of Israel themselves, which have always been settler colonial in nature, but have morphed into a more unapologetic, more cruel and ugly form of kind of more genocidal intents that's written, you know, more expressly and communicated to the world. And then there's a political formation question of seeing the ways in which Palestinian liberation is so central to the other causes that I was already working on.
Okay.
So if you talk to South Africans, you know, I lived and worked in Johannesburg, South Africa, and you ask them about, you know, the causes internationally that have inspired them and that they hold close when they think about their successful struggle against apartheid, they will always talk about Palestine. Even in living in Delhi, when I did, there I was amazed. This was the first time that I was living abroad when I first moved to New Delhi.
What year was this?
In 2013, okay. 2012, 2013. And campus culture, the way in which students were really mobilized was on questions of Palestinian liberation. I had never seen anything like this before. I didn't understand what is the relationship between India and Palestine. Then I came to Latin America, you know, whether it was living in Mexico City or a place like Havana, Cuba, where Palestine is such an important piece of the solidarity movement for the Cuban Revolution. So part of it was seeing how being educated, not through the lens necessarily of mom and dad, but seeing how in these other places I was living and working, the cause of Palestine and the resistance to that settler colonial project had been a source of inspiration for so many other people I was working with. And then there was, you know, just exposure to those practices and policies of the State of Israel itself. In 2023, I went for the first time to visit the occupied territories. And that was a revelation.
So
in
previously,
itself.
Had you visited Israel?
Or
was
this never
your first?
Been.
So this was your first trip to Israel and the occupied.
And they never forgot it.
Okay.
I went to Luton Airport. Big mistake. Flying El Al to Tel Aviv. And I was at the gate waiting to board my flight. Everyone else had already boarded. It's the last person. I'm at the gate. They're just waiting for me. And the guy who works for El Al, he was managing the question of, do you get on the plane or not? Which, you know, only airline where they have litmus tests for your politics at the gate, you know? He's looking at my passport and he's like, you're 30. I had just turned 30. Or almost thereabouts. I said, yeah? And you've never been to Israel? And I said, no. And you're Jewish? And I said, yes, I'm Jewish. I said, and you were bar mitzvah? I said, I was. He goes, recite a prayer for me. And
that's
I was like,
interesting.
Oh, you can't be serious. Is a commercial airline. I'm flying to Tel
Aviv. Yes.
Say a prayer. So I said, you know, I started saying a prayer. I go, okay. Sing a song for me. Sing a Jewish song or Israeli song. And I, you know, I could see everyone looking at me from the plane, like glued to the window. This can't really be happening. I'm trying to find a song that I can remember. I'd gone to a Jewish summer camp. So I was really immersed in this kind of culture of celebration and song. So luckily they had one at hand. And he goes, okay. Do a dance. Sure, do you want an Israeli dance?
You're kidding me.
So there I am at Luton Airport, you know, dancing an Israeli dance that some moves I was taught at at summer camp, at Camp El Onim, in Simi Valley, California. And finally, I'm sort of sufficiently Jewish for this El Al flight steward to let me on the plane. And that was the first inkling, of course, that something was wrong in the relationship between critical parts of the Jewish diaspora and the state of Israel itself, which, of course, would find full expression in the experience of the Global Samud Flotilla. Something was wrong in the way that the relationship between what I was sold as a child about the state of Israel, this is your homeland, this is your protector, this is your place, citizenship is yours whenever you want it, and the actual position of the state of Israel, increasingly, and really exclusively in the past 10, 20 years, which is if you're not sufficiently loyal, if you're not the right kind of Jew, then maybe you don't belong here. So that experience was coupled with actually being on the ground in Palestine, which, you know, I'm always encouraging viewers or listeners, if you haven't visited the occupied territories, if you feel passionately about these issues, it's really important to be there and see these places for yourself and understand the occupation with your own eyes. And this was May 2023, so many months before October 23, when everything kicked off, and they were just flying overhead and bombing Gaza. Every hour we could hear the planes flying overhead. And
where were you based when you could hear them bombing in Gaza?
Oh, we were like deep in the Negev at that point with some Bedouin communities. But no one cared. I mean, it was such normalized violence, to say nothing of the kind of processes of sort of silent annexation and settler
violence. What was your experience in the West Bank like with in both like Ramallah and Palestinian cities? And then also, I mean, did you go to a settlement? Did you see what that's
like? Of course.
Like?
Yeah, I don't think my experience is that dissimilar from any visitor, new or veteran visitor to the occupied territories, to see kind of the architecture of apartheid, which you see in a place like Hebron, as much as you see as in the hills of Hebron, for example, where you see this encroaching process of annexation. I think there's many aspects of that are really stunning, and that were even more striking to me when I returned a year ago in October 2024 to revisit, to see how fast this process is moving, even as a lot of attention is dedicated to questions of genocide in Gaza. Rightly, a lot of these other processes of occupation, really of colonization, are continuing apace. So I was very struck by, seeing gates around even the smallest Palestinian community to say, even if you're 200 people living in this little settlement with no supermarket, we're going to put a gate here. And if we just decide that you will not leave this small community for one day, 2 days, 3 days, it's up to us when we want to allow for you to have any mobility. Or going to Kusra to stand with the olive harvest and seeing the ways in which there is really no hard line. There is no really line at all between armed settlers and the so-called Israel Defense Forces themselves. These things are kind of a piece and highly coordinated. And, when it comes to attacking the olive harvest, they do so in concert, despite however many, solidarity activists attempt to stand in their way. So I think these were, at a personal level, at a political level, all highly motivating in terms of, choosing to take part, for example, in an initiative like the Flotilla, which is just one of the many things that we do under the aegis of this Progressive International that I founded and helped to coordinate.
When did you found that?
So about 5 years ago, it was becoming clear to many, many of us around the world that the forces of the far right were increasingly well coordinated, that whether it was Netanyahu and Trump or Bolsonaro in Brazil or Modi in India, there was a network that was growing that wasn't just these faces, but was also financiers and foundations. It was also industrialists and tech entrepreneurs that were coordinating to advance a kind of common agenda of extraction, exclusion, exploitation. And in fact, that those leaders depended on that network to allow them to thrive. Israel, for example, Netanyahu's political prospects depend hugely on the you know, Silicon Valley of Tel Aviv, tech development, security tech development, and the export of repressive technologies like Pegasus, for example, through the NSO group, to leaders around the world. Many people, for example, you know, ask how it's possible Israel has such impunity on the world stage. It's not just because of its sponsorship with the United States. It's also because of this structural power that it exercises through the development of these technologies and security, you know, new toys that they can basically sell to autocrats around the world, principally. So a lot of us were very concerned about the formation of that kind of network, thought that, you know, we needed more infrastructure to help coordinate progressive or democratic or anti-authoritarian actors around the world, and we needed more effective ties, more effective coordination between those forces, between continents like, you know, Africa and Asia, Latin America, and Europe. And so we were building that infrastructure when really the genocide began in earnest. And then we were attempting to basically do any kind of action that we could facilitate at the international level. So some of those things were very trade union oriented. We began working with a network of, or building and coordinating with a network of dock workers in places like France and Spain, in the United States, in even Morocco and Tunisia, to block shipments of weapons, right? We began to coordinate a big team of investigators and researchers to reveal the tracking, the production and deployment and distribution of weapons and petroleum and these kinds of networks that were sustaining the Israeli war machine. We were working with parliamentarians to build a big network of political forces that were advocating for an arms embargo. We were trying many, many different things, and many of them were just not working. I think that from the Progressive International, I shared a sense that millions of people around the world had, that of frustration, of desolation, of desperation in the face of such kind of senseless slaughter that we were seeing streamed onto our cell phones every day. And so I think that you know, that's when we began to ramp up some of these actions and activities. That's when we began to build what's now known as the Hague Group, which was coming out of that sense of desperation that, wow, the United Nations as an organ of global governance is failing to attend to the basic necessities of the people of Palestine in the face of this genocidal assault. What if we can build a more bespoke coalition of states that will stand up for international law and the fundamental rights of the Palestinian people? And I think the flotilla was just another tactic around the same set of questions, which is how can we more effectively coordinate from our communities to our parliaments, to our street mobilizations, to our sea mobilizations, to confront this war machine and to confront the complicity that sustains it, to kind of move towards the liberation of Palestine, as distant as that dream may seem today.
Okay, I want to go back to kind of two points in your intellectual journey. So you started this organization about 5 years ago. I'm guessing pro-Palestine or anti-Zionist, that was the foundation of it, but not the only thing, right? So just we'll speak to that later. But by the time you're boarding that plane in May 2023, you're already are running this organization. Mm-hmm. So your politics are pretty clearly defined. But then there was this, just walk me back again to this moment where, you know, you're straddling a world where you can feel for the liberation of Palestine, but you still kind of don't feel a responsibility, if that's the right word, for Israel's actions, whereas that kind of changes. And I think a good way to actually answer it is, what did you think of Jerry Seinfeld 10 years ago? And what do you think of Jerry Seinfeld now?
I think that one of the major motivations for a lot of people in the Jewish diaspora in taking on the issue in a more active way and feeling more ownership of the question of Palestinian liberation in terms of it being an urgent and necessary issue for us to own and act on has been the way in which the state of Israel, more than normal in the course of this genocide, for example, has deployed the symbolism that once adorned our synagogues and has attempted to usurp the ceremonies that are so important to our religious celebrations. So when I see the Star of David emblazoned onto the ruins of Gaza and visible from satellite, when we see Rosh Hashanah, New Year dinner, being celebrated in the ethnically cleansed refugee camps of Jenin, this, I think, usurpation of our heritage and our culture and our traditions, I think is particularly offensive, particularly mobilizing. I would be lying if I didn't say that the experience of the weaponization of anti-Semitism as well has also been a radicalizing experience for all of us, or those of us who I think are committed to this particular struggle from the Jewish diaspora. You know, I was living and working in Britain for a significant portion of the so-called Corbyn project, and seeing those smears, seeing the ways that in my name, there was a campaign that was led to smear and smother a left-wing candidate and to weaponize or utilize my identity to do that. That was enraging. And of course, that was just the narrow case of Jeremy Corbyn. We could see this happening all over the world, this conflation of anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism, this way in which it became a really powerful weapon to hit over the heads of the political opponents of the right. I think that that was deeply disturbing for me, as it was for many, many others. And having a conversation so dominated by so-called authorities in our community, I mean, the Jewish Board of Deputies of this country, for example, like a hard Zionist, you know, anti-socialist, anti-Corbyn, I was like, what do you mean? My Jewish tradition is a radical one. In my family lineage, the Bolshevik one. I mean, we don't respect the hierarchy of a board of deputies. I mean, this is totally anathema to our understanding of what Judaism is and should be. So seeing the ways in which the establishment architecture of the Jewish community was supposed to be, was sort of speaking on my behalf in the name of my security, in the name of my feelings of safety, in order to supersede the feelings of Palestinians, for example, or in order to attack and smear political opponents, I think that was also a vector of kind of conflict or increasing commitment from large parts of the diaspora that maybe were, for whatever reason, thinking about other issues or more committed to other causes at that time.
Okay, and then, I mean, just... I know I asked the question a bit flippantly about Seinfeld, but I actually think it's a good gauge of outsiders trying to understand what you're talking about, right? So, like, yeah, I mean, 10 years ago, what did you think of Seinfeld? And now that you, I mean, maybe you already were like 10 years ago, Seinfeld's a pretty bad guy, based on his, you know, the way he has co-opted a lot of, set the language and gone to military camps and stuff like that and been very pro-IDF. But now when you for the last 2 years, when we see, you know, he's a lot of his skits being interrupted or his shows being interrupted with pro-Palestinian activists, and to a large extent he's often quite deriding of them. Has there been, like, do you see a change even in him, and maybe, and like, what's your own sort of relationship with, like, what you'd consider as, you know, people who are Jewish and they've built a Jewish identity outside of Israel, which is away from Israel, as you mentioned earlier, but increasingly that gets eroded as they sometimes start betting hard of Israel.
Yeah, totally. I think it's impossible to understate how radical the transformation in the past 2 years has been, and how successful the movement has been at shifting the needle and in clarifying the stakes of Zionism, even for communities that are very far away from the state of Israel. In Los Angeles, where I grew up, Zionism was just, like I said, it was not a hostile, or it was not a reactive one. It was like the water we were swimming in. It was the air we were breathing. Hollywood as an industry was so naturally and impulsively loyal to this project that no one really ever questioned it. So it's really night and day now. The past 2 years have been a process of intense, rapid, and for many people, very violent kind of clarification of where people stand. And, you know, it started slowly. It started with people maybe wearing a pin on a red carpet. And now it's exploded the city that I came from. Now it's exploded this industry. Now you have, you know, big studios making blacklists of actors that they feel are too radical or too pro-Palestinian. You have big agencies that are basically making their artisans, signees, you know, basically sign on a contract to say that we're going to control your social media output for the course of this campaign to, you know, drum up sales for your movie. So there is something rumbling around, I think, even in a place that was as placid and as impulsively Zionist as Los Angeles, that something has changed night and day now. And of course, you know, I was never a fan of the, and I think the question is less like, what did I think of a Jerry Seinfeld? It's more like, how much were we told that this is just what it is? I mean, this is just how the town works. And these are unquestionable aspects of the architecture of kind of this industry that now are suddenly under intense and almost existential question. So it's been a long time since I've lived there, but it's amazing to see how that has really split the community. And ultimately, you know, my own experience as a participant on that flotilla was part of that process. So, you know, like I said before, for a lot of people, even the ones who are sympathetic to the suffering of the Palestinian people, it's still a humanitarian crisis that's quite far away. Here we are in California, they're all the way over there in the Middle East, and something terrible is happening, but, you know, I'm just going to go to brunch, so to speak. But I think what was interesting about being on the flotilla was trying to help a lot of people in that same community bring the issue back home. This is why I think it's such an effective action. It's because it takes something that is distant and impersonal, faceless in many ways, and all of a sudden that structure of violence that seeks to detain and disappear or torture or abuse or, you know, its opponents, all of a sudden becomes very personal. So I think the broader point I'm trying to make is I feel a part of a larger process of a profound transformation in the politics of the Jewish diaspora that has left almost no stone unturned. There's almost no corner left of the Jewish community, I think, around the world that has not been really affected in ways that are both active and passive toward a more robust position of solidarity with the people of Palestine.
Okay, I've mentioned earlier on that we were on the flotilla, and you've mentioned it a few times. I understand that you also were detained, abducted initially by Israel and then detained. Can you tell us about that experience, the whole thing? So getting on the flotilla, did you board in Barcelona or Tunis, what that was like, and then the process of getting abducted, and then if you can give us some insights into what it was like and how you were treated by Israeli prison guards.
Yeah, I think I'll just run through maybe a few quick scenes so as not to sort of retell the whole story, which I think many of your viewers or listeners will be familiar with the general contours. But for me, I'd come to Barcelona because the organizers of the flotilla had requested some help from myself and from my organization to make sure there was no bureaucratic sabotage of their efforts to bring the boats and leave from the port of Barcelona, which was a big thing they were quite concerned about for good reason, and to bring some activists and militants down to the port of Barcelona to celebrate the departure of the flotilla. When I got there, I saw grandmothers and grandfathers and school teachers and nurses and students and people from everywhere, like Malaysia and Colombia to France and the UK. And I just thought, you know, really, you don't, you know, look at these amazing people. These people, you know, infirm or immature, wherever they are in their lives and political formation, are willing to drop everything and show the kind of moral courage and conviction and clarity to take part in this mission, then can't you? So I was very moved by the composition of the flotilla, which was not just professional activists. It wasn't just hardcore militants. It was really a lot of ordinary people who were brought together by that shared sense of moral conviction. And so I was very moved to join. And I think the course of the voyage was only served to reveal, not just to the participants, but to the world, just how far the State of Israel has gone in its, not disregard for international law would be a bit too sanguine, in its outright intends to override any stricture, any institution or norm or principle that should govern the international order to attack and, you know, lash out against perceived enemies. So one thing that was so striking about the journey was Benjamin Netanyahu personally approving a submarine to traverse the Mediterranean Sea and deploy these drones against our boats that were spitting out incendiary devices to destroy or incapacitate the boats that were sailing in the flotilla. I mean, this is almost impossible to imagine any other country doing this. Humanitarian workers in international waters being subject to drone strikes at sea. It's just so scandalous. And it was so difficult to get the attention of, you know, the BBC and the New York Times, and to say, to sort of speak out, to condemn, to even report on these kinds of crimes. And if we did do it, they were all couched in language like activists allege, attack on the sea. And we're like, here's the CCTV. I don't know what you mean by allege. Do we do this to ourselves? Was this a false flag? And that was a lot of the accusations we got online. So, you know, part of the journey was trying to engage in this information warfare on the other side of it, being slandered as nothing but, you know, criminals and terrorists organized through syndicates of anti-Israel geopolitical forces, and be like, no, actually, we're just ordinary people who are deeply unnerved and deeply disturbed by this genocide. Saying that we weren't carrying any aid, we were just there as provocateurs, and saying, no, we're humanitarian workers, you know, here are the lentils and rice and baby formula and medicine that we're bringing along with us. Part of it was trying to see if we couldn't use the opportunities of sailing along the sea, the largest humanitarian convoy in history, larger than some of all previous missions, to try to represent the feelings of so many hundreds of millions of people around the world. So we not being there as individuals, but being there as representatives of broader communities. Whether that's your professional community, you're a nurse, Israel has systematically targeted medical professionals in Gaza to incapacitate its health system, for example. Or you're a journalist, where Israel has systematically targeted journalists and prevented international attention from reaching into Gaza. I think everyone on the boats felt like a representative of a broader community, and I think that's what made the reaction from the state of Israel so aggressive, that they wanted to send a message, a very clear message, that they were not going to tolerate that kind of robust expression of international solidarity, and they would do whatever was in their power, and a lot was in their power, to intimidate and to discourage that kind of mission. So that ranged from the violent abduction that you were describing at sea when we reached the red zone, this fictional space that the state of Israel has drawn on the map to say that they have a right to patrol in international waters, where they were trying to ram our boats and drown their passengers, and in a great act of piracy, steal our belongings and the boats as if it was their right to do so. And that went all the way through the pretty systematic abuse, sometimes torture, and serial violation of basic rights that the people in the flotilla endured in Katsiot, in the internment camp in the Negev Desert, where we were eventually taken after, you know, being strip searched and zip tied and blindfolded and spit onto a police van and sent out into the middle of the desert. So I think the broader point in the experience of the flotilla was just that we were trying to communicate to the world was, if they're capable, if they're willing, if they're even eager to enact this kind of violence against those grandmothers and those grandfathers, against these journalists and these trade unionists, against representatives of the international community, with the eyes of the world fixed to this mission, we can only imagine the kind of violence that's being committed under the cover of darkness in a network of torture camps that we don't know about, that are truly reserved for the Palestinian detainees that don't get the same kind of care, attention, coverage, or solidarity necessarily. And that's how rogue this country has become. And I think that was really one of the goals of the mission. And of course, we didn't succeed in our principal ambition, which was to break the siege and to establish a permanent humanitarian corridor at sea so Gazans can recover some control as a precondition of their overall self-determination of their own shores. But that's why I think all of us have returned home eager, committed to the next flotilla, to returning bigger and better and badder and more effectively coordinated, even more representative, so that we finally can break the siege and deliver on that on that mission. And I think that is what is so scary to the state of Israel and to this government in particular, is the idea that their efforts to silence, intimidate, attack, or undermine the solidarity movement are backfiring in critical ways and just creating, you know, two activists where one was before, or activating a whole community in a place like Los Angeles that was silent or deactivated before this violence was enacted against us.
Yeah, I mean, you can you give me a few anecdotes, perhaps, of just what it was like being detained, personal experiences you saw? Just, I mean, like you mentioned, of course, the treatment of Palestinians is something we can only imagine. I mean, it's also been documented by rights groups and testimonies of Palestinians who are taken captive. But just, you know, from your own experience, I mean, there may be many people have probably heard about it, but others who are watching may not have.
Sure.
So just give us some of those, just so we can have an insight into what Israeli security personnel and Ben-Gvir himself who attended.
Yeah. You know, when we were taken after abduction to the port of Ashdod, I think maybe in my head I was thinking, oh, maybe we'll get treated not nicely, but perhaps because of all the attention that's on this delegation, on these humanitarian workers, yeah, they'll throw us in a jail and find a way to deport us. But I was wrong. I was wrong because what had become clear once we got to port was that we were being made an example of, and that Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, in particular, the most radical component of the present cabinet, the Minister of Security, who's in charge of basically the execution and design and execution of these torture schemes for Palestinian detainees, he was in charge, and he wanted to show the world what he's capable of. So when we got there, you know, instead of a normal processing facility, they had lined us all up in rows, set everyone out with their, you know, heads down, on our knees, people getting sort of beaten into place. If you moved a muscle, they were gonna kick you or punch you back into place, so that Ben-Gvir could come and have a photo opportunity. Now, for me, that meant after they found out that I was Jewish, that meant taking me away from the group for a special photo opportunity with Minister Ben-Gvir, where I was sat, you know, directly in front of this big flag of the State of Israel as a show of confrontation, loyalty, the disloyal Jew in front of the real symbol of our community, which was the flag of the State of Israel, so that Ben-Gvir could come yell in my face that I'm a terrorist. And that was kind of the protocol that was issued against everyone. Some things were shocking at the beginning, like seeing the way that they brutalized some of the people who were on the boats. An old woman I watched thrown to the ground. She, I think, broke her leg for no reason. People having their jewelry stripped from them when they got off the boats, which of course recalls some of the most horrific images of what happened to our people in the 20th century. People having life-saving medicine just thrown away and told, well, you should have thought about that before you came to Israel. After, of course, we didn't come to Israel, they forcibly abducted us and brought us to Israel. So these were some of the early telltale signs that we were going to be treated in a way that was not congruent, perhaps we can say, with international law or any existing norm or institution around our fundamental rights. You know, we weren't going to see a judge, a jury. We weren't going to see a prosecutor or a lawyer. We weren't going to talk to our families, or let alone shower or enjoy any kind of those privileges. We were going to be treated as terrorists or as prisoners of war in an extrajudicial space. And that became clear when we were actually taken to the camp. You know, there, anyone who spoke out, anyone who prayed, there were obviously lots of Muslims as part of the delegation, anyone who was perceived to be disobedient in some way to the prison guard's perception of order in their camp, was promptly, you know, they went to the cells with a German shepherd and a shotgun and tear gas, and they ripped people out of cells, you know, shackled them at hands and ankles, threw them in a kind of birdcage in the sun without any food or water in isolation for hours and hours and hours and hours until we tried to get them back. People were wailing for medicine, basic medicine, insulin for diabetics. One woman had such a severe kidney infection that she was turning blue and passing out from the pain. And we were not able to get any medical attention. One friend in the cell next to me, a young Jewish American, in fact, was screaming out, asking for medical attention, just on such severe withdrawals from medication that they'd thrown away when we were back at the port. And they just came and said, we're not going to give any medicine to animals. And it was like this kind of protocol. A protocol that clearly they know well. This was not hard for them to develop because I think it's a pretty familiar protocol that's deployed in light form against us, but in heavy form against our Palestinian brothers and sisters. But this was all about showing us, a lesson, which is why, for example, on day three or so, they installed these big flat screen televisions in the prison cell block and played 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 hours in a row at maximum volume. Compilations of October 7th footage. This was about saying, you think you're showing solidarity with the people of Palestine. Actually, you're animals, you're monsters, you're terrorists. And we're going to remind you how we treat terrorists. So I think that there was, it was revealing in this way of just kind of how far the State of Israel has come in the exercise of extrajudicial law and how much the myth of the State of Israel as a kind of Western liberal democracy that abides by rule of law has been exploded by its own radical elements like Ben-Gvir, who just don't care. And of course, to a U.S. American like me, how much that's of a piece with what we see in the Trump camp, for example, and its own interpretations of international law. I mean, I think that there is, speaking of the reactionary international or the, the far-right forces that are organizing across the world, there's a common philosophy there that if you're an enemy of the state, if you're a terrorist, if you're perceived to be a threat to our national interest, then we're going to act with whatever means we deem to be appropriate to deal with that threat, to exterminate that threat, to ride roughshod over international law, to make an example of our enemies in the name of our national security.
Thanks. That's quite harrowing to hear. I've heard it, from a few people now, but just always kind of in first person, it's always a bit harrowing. Final question. I know you stretch for time, but you spoke about your Jewish identity. You spoke about how that's changing. You've spoken about how this awful genocide, the acceleration of Israel's brutality, which all of us are seeing, has really made finding yourself being a Jew in this world complicated, right? Where do you think Israel's actions over the last, 80 years, but specifically in the last 2 years, where do you think it leaves Jewish identity?
I think the State of Israel presents an existential risk to Jewish identity. I think that if there is not a more radical and robust movement in the Jewish diaspora, as well as in the State of Israel, to stand up and say, not in my name, we're not going to allow this, usurpation or occupation or betrayal of our cultures and traditions, but needs to speak out on behalf of a different kind of Judaism, we risk what the State of Israel has long sought to do, which is to claim, monopolize those traditions and those symbols on behalf of the project. If we don't hold the line on the distinction between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism, if we allow the IHRA definition or any of these other legal frameworks to forge an institutional architecture that protects the monopoly that Israel seeks to hold on Jewish identity, that is an existential risk to, I think, to our heritage. So I feel lucky to be part of, I think, the first generation, certainly in my country, of Jews that are beginning to speak out and get organized in different social movements and different campus organizations to try to chart another course for our kind of Jewish tradition. And I think that that's really exciting, but it's not enough. I think that, we need to continue to be building those things across the world. It's very heterogeneous in terms of the geography. I think the U.S., it's actually one of the most robust countries now in terms of how the Jewish community is speaking out against the state of Israel. I think in large parts of Europe and other parts of Latin America, for example, it's not the case that there is that rumbling effort to recover our identity and our culture and heritage from the state of Israel. But I think that it would be impossible to understate the stakes of that process. And that's to say, like, I know a lot of people who in the choice between kind of exit voice and loyalty to the Jewish identity have chosen exit. They've just said, you know, I don't even feel Jewish anymore. Like, this is such a stain on our conscience, such a stain on the world's conscience, but such a stain on the name of Judaism. That I don't really want to be associated with this religion anymore or with this tradition. I know a lot of people who've gone in that direction. And I think if we don't want, it's understandable, but I think it's also very sad, because I think that there is a tradition that I would like us to try to defend because of its richness, because of the ways in which, you know, Jews throughout history have sought to stand up in solidarity with oppressed peoples around the world. So I believe that it's possible to chart that course. I just think we're running out of time. And I think that's the urgency that guides me and so many people in a lot of this work.
Awesome. Thank you so much, David. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Cheers.